It has been a long week. We talked about tasers in elementary schools, craft beer, and the challenges women face behind bars. So as we do every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Oh, my goodness me! Phoenix thinks she's done it, and Shaunae Miller has collapsed across the line.
I need a vacation.
It's collard greens.
That doesn't really make sense, because you don't call them collared people. That's offensive.
Joining us in the break room, Kalina Poehler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast, Robbie Medwed, an Atlanta-based LGBT educator and activist, Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and Greg Williams is host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Since it's Friday and we're just about at the finish line, let's talk first about finish lines. Former UGA runner Shaunae Miller won a gold medal in the Olympics for the Bahamas. She dove at the last second at the finish line in the women's 400-meter race. Miller's dive put her ahead of Felix by 0.07 seconds. And in an interview with CCTV after the race, Miller was totally unapologetic.
Sometimes you just can't control it, and you know, it's a part of the sport, so you know, I don't really let things get to me, so I saw it and I was just like, ah, it's whatever. But you know, I got my gold medal, so I'm happy right now.
All right, diving is allowed by track and field athletes. A runner officially crosses the finish line when his or her torso crosses, and a photo of the finish revealed that Miller's torso was slightly in front of Felix's as she dove. But it has raised a controversy of people wondering, should this be allowed? What do we think?
Should it be allowed? I don't think so, because you're running and you're on feet, and that's the point. However, if it is allowed, then absolutely use it. You're in the Olympics. This is the one time to get a gold medal, so if the rules are there, they're not breaking any rules. Morally, okay, maybe it's not so great, but you know, I'm going to use every advantage that I have that's legal to me to get the gold medal if I'm in that place.
Okay, maybe not the spirit of the law, but the letter. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I as a UGA grad, I was quite happy to see UGA come out ahead on that one. But, you know, she ran for 99.9% of the race. So I think that diving across the finish line is certainly acceptable. And, you know, this race only happens once every 4 years. So and the good news about the Internet is everybody became experts in track and field rules after the controversy. I mean, I know a lot about how the torso comes first. So.
Right. And then every runner, as they reach the finish line, they're all leaning forward in some way. So in a way, they're all diving in a way. They may not be absolutely horizontal like she was, but, you know, I don't think it's a problem.
Yeah. Where do you draw the line between a trip or a lean, a dive? How can you tell? Let's just make a rule and stick with whatever the rule is and not make a fuss about.
I'm just amazed that she can dive and not tear up all of her skin. Mm-hmm. I mean, I walk down the street and fall down and I'm bleeding everywhere. How can you dive across a track like
These are
that?
Professionals.
Exactly. I'm just not a professional faller, I guess.
And some of the furor was basically, if Allyson Felix had done it and the USA had won, the narrative would have been, look, she sacrificed everything for gold. But because it was a Bahamian, was that how you say it?
Asking the wrong question.
You don't have any Bahamas in you, you have everything else.
Yeah, almost everything else. All right, let's move on to a considerably more serious controversy. Actor and director Nate Parker. An alleged rape from 1999 has resurfaced. It happened while he was a student at Penn State. Parker and roommate Jean Celestine were accused of assaulting an unconscious female student. That female student tragically later committed suicide. Mm. Variety reporter Brent Lang told NPR's Audie Cornish Parker went on trial and was eventually acquitted.
Part of the reason that the jury found him to be not guilty seems to be the fact that he had had a consensual sexual encounter with the female the day before the alleged rape took place.
So this news breaks as Parker's film, The Birth of a Nation, is going to be released, already generating Oscar buzz. Celestine is Parker's co-writer on the movie. But, okay, here's the question. Let's say at this point you now have doubts about his character. But can you separate and should you separate the art from the artist?
I have a really hard time separating it out. I really want to. I know that I could, and maybe even sometimes possibly should, but there's so many times that I just can't split the two. I see musicians and all these things, and I know that whatever money I'm spending on their stuff is going to go to them, and they're not going to face the consequences. And maybe not my dollar getting to them isn't going to be such of a consequence, but I just have a really hard time not separating them out.
Mm. Well, I'm a little. I am a little. I'm on the edge with this because I know how important the subject of this film is going to be. And I know that this is truly going to be a work of art from all accounts. I did not feel the same way when, you know, we put R. Kelly on trial. I don't think, you know, the remix to Ignition is any sort of art. That said, you know, I honestly am really, really, really upset about this whole thing because I wanted to go into the film, you know, wholeheartedly, and I feel like I can't. I feel like I'm almost been let down by the art. Artist, and I feel like the artist
first time it's
now.
Come up. It's not just R. Kelly. We've got Roman Polanski, at which there's questions.
Right.
Woody Allen.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Almost any New York director, really. Right.
But does it affect his credibility in producing, as Kalina has said, an important topic that he's covering? We have to be able to trust what he's producing on an important topic, and that's where we have to determine whether or not this impacts his credibility.
Well, and I've always been able to kind of separate the two. You know, anytime most of the actors and musicians, they tend to lean to the left. So, you know, if we get into this little game of trying to, well, I don't believe in his politics, so I'm just not going to listen to him. We'd never be able to go to movies as conservatives. So,
yeah, but there's
a big difference between
someone's politics and then a rape. Or with like Wagner, who, you know, notorious composer,
anti-Semitic.
But huge anti-Semitic for the Nazis. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
That's not the same as, oh, this person spoke out for this candidate. I don't really like that candidate either. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a big difference there.
Unfortunately, people are actually they're becoming intertwined from what I'm seeing. So, yeah, I mean, if somebody is a convicted child molester, but they paint really good, I mean, what you know, how do you balance those two?
Yeah,
right?
There you go. There's a lot of painters with troubled lives. We would love to get your opinions on this. Can you separate the art from the artist? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join us on Facebook. We got a tweet from Sansara Taylor who says the Birth of a Nation can contribute to liberation. Re-prosecuting Nate Parker does not. So send us your comments as well. We're in the break room with Sam Burnham of All the Biscuits in Georgia, Robbie Medved, Kalina Bowler, and Greg Williams. Since we're making comments on internet stories, that leads me to NPR. National Public Radio will no longer allow public comments at its website.
No, look at the comments section. The comments are already rubbish.
There's five separate threads debating what constitutes rape, and someone with an anime avatar just said the N-word.
Yeah, that's why you don't read the comments.
Just stop reading the comments. It's a cabaret of crazies all vying for your attention.
So NPR joins Reuters, The Guardian, The Daily Beast, lots and lots of media companies in ending comments. The managing editor of digital news at NPR says the comment section was not providing a useful experience for the vast majority of our users. And numbers back that up. Less than 1% of NPR's audience actually commented on a story last month, for example. So how do we feel about this?
Let's get rid of it. Bye.
You're okay with it.
I'm totally fine with it.
Well, I'm happy with, you know, any media or organization making their own choice. If they do think that the comments section is adding valuable discussion points, then leave it up there. I think that, I mean, in this room, everybody pretty much likes Twitter, and Twitter's where the mean people really do live. And the comments section can also serve as a spam. There's viruses out there. So I think that if you're going to have a comments section, you should make people really register with their real name and verify that it's a human and not somebody that has 37 little avatars up and they, you know.
No anonymous comments.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. No. You got to stand by what you're saying. I have no problem getting rid of the comment section. I think there are plenty of ways people can make themselves heard these days. But if we are going to have the comment section, I want people to stand by what they say.
Yeah, I want it to be I want you to have your name on there and a picture of you, and that way we know that it's a literal person and not somebody that's just spewing hate speech or trying to push an agenda on their own.
But at the same time, a news organization, they're just trying to, you know, like NPR, and you know, they're trying to get journalism out there. Mm-hmm. And I feel that a comment section with a news organization is probably going to take away from some of the, you know, just being able to Sarah's story, here's what's going on, XYZ, and we're done. Next, let's move on. You know, like if it's a blog, you know, and you want more
like
interaction.
It's editorial, right?
Right, yeah. Right. I don't think, you know, NPR needs a comment section.
But a news story, when I get to the comment section, I know I'm done scrolling. It's time to go elsewhere.
Do you have do you allow public comments at your blog?
I have moderated comments. And again, I don't get many comments, but at the same time, where do you draw that line? What is acceptable in your comment section as a blogger? And when are you stifling conversation? So maybe it's better to not have a comment section.
I think it becomes also more complicated for news organizations because people post incorrect things in the comment section.
That's true.
And then are we then obliged to go in there and correct the factual error?
Right. Well, once you start responding to the comments, then you're lost. But I think we also have to remember that not everybody's opinion really needs to be heard. I really am a firm believer that not every opinion in the world deserves a microphone. And I think especially if the only place that you can get your opinion across is in the comments, that's a big sign. Otherwise, then if your opinion really is that good, it's going to find its way out into all of these other mainstream places, and you're not going to be the only person with that
comment.
You may
even be a panelist on The Break Room sometime if your opinion is that good.
Exactly. And you comment enough, you're going
to
show up.
Clearly, nobody here ever posts in the comment section because we wouldn't have made the cut to be on the show today.
You know, some of us just, we tweet a lot so that it, in hopes that it gets us here.
Okay. All right. You heard Robbie Medved. Not every opinion needs to be heard. You can respond to that by leaving us a message at 404-500-9457 or just complaints at robbiemedved.com. Oh, my goodness.
It's Friday.
We're at the break room. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, millennials have a problem taking a break from work, and they don't want anyone else to take a break either. That's next from On Second Thought, so stay with us. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We are hanging out in the break room with coffee and conversation, as we do every Friday. My guest today, Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Robbie Medved is an Atlanta-based LGBT educator and activist, and Kalina Bowler co-hosts the Real Snobs podcast. A thank you again to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that fuels our break room guests, and they are online at savannahcoffee.com, and they're the reason why we don't have the bad coffee that you find at so many public radio station. So we're about to get a weekend, but you know, it is nice when you can take a real vacation, right, and come back refreshed to your job. But we have a new report from Project Time Off and GSK. They say the youngest employees in your office are the most likely to be work martyrs. Not only do they not take vacation days, but they shame other people who do take them.
Shame. 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 Shame.
Okay, so surveys show, actually, this is an American problem in a wider sense. Most Americans do not use up all of their vacation days. But why millennials? Why are they so prone to not only stay at work, but why do they have a problem with other people taking a break? And I'm looking at you, Kalina Bowler.
Yeah, because, okay, I'm staring off in the distance trying to think about this. I think this is a younger millennial generation issue because I'm on the older side and I'm trying to get a vacation like right now. And I just went back to work. You know what I mean? That said, I wonder if it is just a symptom of being young, going through, you know, the economic collapse we just went through and how much, you know, and how afraid everyone is of not being able to make money and save money and that sort of thing. I think a lot of younger people that are just getting into the workforce are realizing, oh, crap, I'm not going to have, the same opportunities my parents had when they were, you know, my age. Therefore, let me just go up and work and things of that nature.
Yeah, they realize their degree in ancient Sumerian poetry isn't going to land them the six-figure job, right?
Well, oh, come on now.
What kind of latte would you like with that, sir?
But a lot of folks aren't making enough money to even bother with a vacation, so I'm going to stay home and may as well, okay, I'll check the email. Oh, you know, and I'll just go on in. That kind of thing. I don't, I've had to save up a lot of money to go on any vacations that I've wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot harder for other folks to think about that. I compare myself to a lot of my friends or younger friends who their apartments are really, really nice and they've got a lot of really nice stuff and that's where they're spending their money. And my apartment's not so nice so that I can go on vacations.
Mm. And it may be a response because we have this stereotype.
But we're not getting to the second half of why they're shaming other people.
Well, but I think there's probably this stereotype on the millennials that, you know, we say they're lazy. They're entitled. They're this, they're that. And their response is, look, I'm working. I'm here. I'm not taking time off. Where are you going? You're the one telling me I'm lazy and you're laying on the beach. And I'm here, you know, busting my head against the wall working.
And it's also this generation, too, where millennials have grown up being tethered literally to their smartphones, where you never really can escape from work if you don't want to. And they're also used to prying into other people's lives with, you know, by following people on social media, Facebook comments and everything. So maybe that they're basically a generation of busybodies.
But also the easiest way to make yourself look better is to put someone else down. It's a lot harder to make yourself look good by just making yourself look good.
So Dan Traynor tweets, why millennials, huge debt, few jobs, low wages, and just last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, the break room shamed lazy kids. I remember that one.
Ooh, guilty.
I'll believe you if we did. Calling you guys out. Speaking of shame. All right, so since we're talking about young people and school especially, a high school in Little Rock, Arkansas has gone viral because they want parents to stay away.
Principal Steve Strasley had this picture posted on the Catholic High School for Boys Facebook page last Wednesday, reading, if you're dropping off your son's forgotten lunch, books, homework, equipment, etc., please turn around and exit the building. Your son will learn to problem solve.
It's simply to help boys avoid the default switch of calling mom and dad when things don't go right and to come bail them out.
All right. Is this too harsh?
No, I am all for this.
100%. Love the idea. I think it's fantastic.
Neither Kalina nor Robbie ever forgot their lunch at home.
That's a lesson you learned once.
I did, and I think I would have benefited from doing without it. And
your mom brought you your biscuits.
Oh, yes. Yes. So I probably should have sat there and watched somebody else eat their biscuits and then realized that the next day I'm going to remember to grab my lunch on the way out the door. And I think it's a Catholic school. It's a private school. If you don't like the policy, don't send your child to this school.
Now, that's an aspect that I can support. But I just think that removing the parent from the equation is kind of, it's a direction that we're headed right now in this country. And it's negative. My mom used to, you know, make my lunch every day.
That
says a lot. Parents are probably listening right now.
Yeah.
And so for, you know, that, and now basically all the schools, even the wealthy kids get free breakfast and free lunch now in certain areas. And that, I think, just removes a part of an interaction that parents can have in their lives. My mom would always put in an extra cookie or something like that uh-huh. made me realize that it was personalized. And I think, you know, when we remove that aspect of it and the parental involvement in their children's lives, you know, that's any type of higher education person will tell you the reason.
So you're saying the person who's supposed to be teaching them responsibility is the parents,
yes,
not necessarily the school.
And, you know, we always say parents aren't involved with their children's school lives, and that's part of the reason we've had a decline in education results here.
Okay,
so
there's a difference between a parent showing up for a PTA meeting or some sort of community organization situation for their child and constantly coddling them and saying, oh, you know, my 12th grader left his lunch at home again. He forgot to do his homework again. He forgot to, you know, and they're leaving their jobs or leaving their homes and coming there and saying, it's okay, sweetie, this, that, and the other. I was in school in undergrad with so many people, and these are adults at this point that I consider them supposed to be adults, who flunked out of freshman year because they're so used to someone saying, get up at a certain time, this, that, and the other. By the time you're in 11th, 12th grade, you should not be, you know, forgetting the basics.
I am so proud of you guys. My left-wing friends are learning personal responsibility.
Come on now. So my
heart is warm now.
Oh, boy.
My parents were at everything, every performance, every game,
right,
all that stuff. But the second I had an issue with a teacher, that was my problem.
Okay.
They would never call the teacher for me, never took a test for me, never did any of that. It was like they will help me get everywhere I could go, get me to the door. But at a certain point, I had to walk through that door. And even though I made my lunch sometimes, my parents made my lunch sometimes, I still had that relationship with them. But we do ask our public institutions to finish the job, to teach us. We don't expect our parents to teach us languages and math and all that stuff. We ask the schools to do that. So it's not really cutting them out.
Yeah, I made my lunch for my kid, but if he forgot it, that was on him.
That's what I'm saying. You can make a lunch all day, but if they
You're going hungry, dude. I'm at work. You can give us your own opinion. We're at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us. We have so many tweets, I can't even read them, or find us on Facebook. We're in the break room with Robbie Medved, Kalina Baller, Sam Burnham, and Greg Williams. So let's move on to tiny houses. The tiny house movement, not just because of that show, but it's very popular. The idea is you live in very small homes. Some of them look like garden sheds. They're less expensive and they have less of an impact on the environment. But some people wonder if not everyone is as concerned about the environment as others. Some people are looking at places like the Butter Bar, which is a popular restaurant in San Francisco. It's a trailer park themed restaurant that prides itself on serving trashy food and drinks. And then you've got fashion, which is intentionally torn and distressed. And you have other restaurants as well that are kind of leading to this poverty chic. And some people who are poor are saying, wait a second, is this appropriating poor culture by people who are wealthy and don't have to live that way? Okay, Greg's already laughing. What do you think, Greg?
Yeah, appropriating poor culture. I guess I hadn't been to the Smithsonian exhibit to see what poor culture is. But I don't know. That's just bizarre to me. So,
Sam?
This cultural appropriation thing, I don't know where it stops, where it begins. How do you know if you're stepping on somebody's toes? How do you know if you're minding your own business? How do you know if you're, am I in my own culture doing this, or am I experiencing someone else's, or am I getting Americanized Chinese food? Am I appropriating that? I mean, where does it start
you,
and end?
You are there's not no... appropriating Chinese culture if you eat Chinese food.
I fortune cookies are not actually Chinese, by the way.
Yeah,
I would say there's a big difference also between appropriating culture and just not having good fashion sense or good taste. You know, we talk like people used to pay hundreds of dollars for ripped jeans when a scissor and a little patience can get the same thing. It's just some people really, they have to have the brand name that goes along with it. It's obnoxious. It's you know, boring and all that kind of stuff. And I do remember back when tiny houses were just called trailer parks. And that's great.
You can make your own jean shorts with scissors, actually.
How many pairs of jean shorts do you have?
Zero. I went to Georgia, not Florida.
Fair enough.
I want zero pictures of any of you in jean shorts. Kalina, you want to weigh in here?
I don't know how to feel about this one. I will say this. When the tiny house movement started, you know, really picking up steam, I said to myself, okay, I get the economical thing about it. I get that, you know, people are trying to downsize. Mortgages really screwed people over, this, that. But I don't know if this is something where people are saying, oh, you know, that homeless guy over there and his tent over there, that there's something about what he's doing. You know what I mean? I think this may be a bit of a stretch, and yet there are going to be people out there that are going to try to, you know, make this a pop culture thing. You know?
Oh, it's already a pop culture thing.
Yeah, definitely.
It's on HGTV. There's TV
have y'all
shows
seen,
about it.
Didn't Decatur just have a tiny house? Y'all have been to IKEA, right? So they have all the designs for, like, here's what you can do with 300 square feet or anybody that's been to
room. Room.
Which is, I think that's cool.
It's helpful.
Yeah, that's helpful. All right, okay. So let's move on to something where I think we might get more differing opinions. Good Morning America host Amy Robach got in hot water this week. She used the phrase colored people when they were having a discussion about diversity in Hollywood.
Hollywood has received recent and quite a bit of criticism for casting white actors in what one might assume should be a role reserved for colored people.
Now, Robach is getting a lot of criticism, but I will say that she almost immediately acknowledged that it was a mistake and inappropriate and apologized and said she meant to say people of color. So my question is, how does one make a mistake without getting reamed out now?
I'm not sure we can make a mistake without getting reamed out. I think the best we can do is apologize as quick as we can.
Which she
and
did.
And then move on. And there are going to be people who are upset at everything. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the comment sections anymore to let out that frustration. So they're going to find other ways to do it. But she really did. I mean, it's a really common mistake to say, you know, you mean to say people of color, and you flip the words because you're talking and there's TV cameras and all those things. She apologized. She moved on.
Yeah. She didn't sound like the type that typically uses racial slurs. Yeah. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about her biography, but she, you know, clearly that was a little bit of a tongue twister for her. And, you know, we have a situation now where we're always walking on eggshells around people. Did I say the wrong thing? I don't really care about walking on eggshells, as we've found out,
yes,
on the show.
That's very true.
A lot of other people do.
Kalina, you're our person of color.
Yes, I'm the person of color and woman in the room today. Listen, I don't feel that the term colored person is so much a racial slur as it is antiquated, an antiquated term that, you know, people tend to use. But the fact that she said, oh, I meant to say person of color, but it came out to be colored person. I would never say colored personally. I would never say a colored person when referring to someone who is of color. I don't know how often she or people in her circle use that term, so maybe for her it may have been something off the top of her head. That said, I don't believe this has anything to do with a racist intention or anything like that. She probably just in her circles uses that term, maybe, and it was easier for her to come up with on the fly as, you know, as a journalist trying to, you know, get the words out there. You
Live
know
radio
I mean?
Is hard.
It's hard.
Yeah. All right. We have like 2.5 minutes left, and let's see if we can get through this one in that period of time. Bill Nye, the science guy, got into a debate about the devastating floods in Louisiana. He said they're caused by global warming. On CNN, Nye called out meteorologist Chad Myers. He did not use his name, who's been in the past has rejected the concept of climate change.
Here at CNN, you have essentially a climate change denier meteorologist, and knock yourselves out. But this is a big problem, and it's not going to go away.
Okay, so here's the question. A meteorologist is technically a scientist. Is it okay? Everyone has different points of view. Should they get equal time?
Well, with climate change, here's the debate on it. Is it man-made climate change? I think everybody can agree the climate has changed on the 4 billion years that the Earth has been around. Climate has changed many, many times. We've gone through many iterations of hot and dry spells. So
That's not really a debate among scientists, though. I mean, that's settled among scientists.
But whether it's man-made or not.
Right. Even that is not really a debate. I want to be clear on the science.
You know, well, me and Sam may still want to debate that point now.
Right.
Among scientists, it's not a debate.
But look at this scenario here, okay? We have floods in Louisiana. Oh, this is climate change. You have a snowstorm up north, and we say, see, look, it's not getting warmer, it's getting colder, and we're told, oh, well, you know, this is weather. This is not climate.
There's more Antarctic ice right now than in the past 50 years. So.
We only have like about 30 seconds left, but the question is not whether you guys would debate it, but whether we should have a scientist on media.
I'm going to go back to, a meteorologist is a scientist, but there are plenty of other meteorologists who are there for fame. I have no problem with a network or somebody saying, we've got brand standards, we've got agency standards, this is our position, and this is how we do things, because there is enough science to back it up. But we see it also in political reporting. We see it in other areas where we really believe that every side deserves something equal, and not every side really all the time is actually an equal conversation.
Oh, yeah,
He almost did it again.
I did, absolutely.
And on that note, we are out of time in the break room. I want to say thank you to everybody. Kalina Baldur, co-host The Real Snobs podcast. Robbie Medved, LGBT educator and activist. Sam Burnham curates All the Biscuits in Georgia blog. And Greg Williams hosts the radio show Greg's List. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
As always, that is our show for today. But we would love to hear from you. You can talk back to us on anything that you just heard, but especially on this issue of whether or not you have a problem with a journalism organization, say, hiring and employing a climate denier. Does it matter? You can tweet us at OST Talk or post to Facebook, as always, for today and the week. That is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.
She stood there bright as the sun on that California coast. He was a Midwestern boy on his own.